the code powering Google, NASA, and like the entire global generative AI explosion, it wasn't built in a massive corporate laboratory.
Right.
It wasn't backed by millions in venture capital. And it definitely wasn't designed by some committee of 50 engineers.
No, not at all.
It was actually built by a single guy working on his Christmas vacation who decided to name his project after a 1970s British comedy troupe.
Which is just, you know, one of the most counterintuitive origin stories in all of technology.
Yeah, completely.
Like, we expect the bedrock of our digital world to be something incredibly dense, right? Something highly mathematical and completely inaccessible to the average person.
We think of something like cold and industrial.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But when you actually dig down into the foundation, you find something entirely different.
And that's what we're getting into today. Welcome to today's deep dive. Whether you're prepping for a major technical transition, looking to pivot your career, or you're just insanely curious about how the digital world is holding itself together, you are in the right place. Today, we are analyzing a comprehensive 2026 guide and syllabus on Python programming. And to really ground this globally, we're drawing some fascinating on-the-ground insights from a specialized training center called Brawley Academy over in Hyderabad, India.
Yeah, and the data in these sources provides just a perfect lens into the current reality of software.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're looking at a single programming language that acts as the primary nervous system for global giants.
Netflix, Instagram, Spotify.
Right. And of course, the entire landscape of large language models.
So our mission today is to figure out how this seemingly quirky language won the global programming wars, you know, how it physically operates under the hood, and what this massive shift means for your own learning journey in 2026. Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with that holiday vacation.
Yeah, the famous Christmas break. So back in the late 1980s, there was this Dutch programmer named Guido van Rossum.
Okay.
He was working at the Centrum Wiskunde in Informatica in the Netherlands. And he had some time off around Christmas in 1989.
Oh,
right. And he just wanted a hobby programming project to keep himself occupied.
Yeah.
He wasn't, you know, operating under some corporate mandate to revolutionize computing.
Which is wild because most people tackle a home improvement project or like read a book. He decides to build the future of global technology infrastructure from his desk.
Pretty much.
And the name, people always assume it's a reference to the snake.
Right, the reptile.
Yeah.
But no, Guido van Rossum was a massive fan of the British comedy series Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. He wanted his new language to capture a specific feeling. He wanted it to feel fun. And most importantly, he wanted it to be approachable. The driving philosophy from day one was prioritizing code readability.
Which is a stark contrast to how things were done at the time, right?
Oh, completely.
Like older languages and even contemporary powerhouses like C++ or Java, they're notoriously verbose.
Very dense.
I always compare traditional languages to reading a highly complex, heavily punctuated legal contract.
That's a great way to put it.
You miss one comma, like one semicolon at the end of line 400, and the whole program crashes.
Yeah, because they require strict, explicit declarations for every single action the computer takes.
Right.
You have to allocate memory, you have to define the exact type of every piece of data, and you have to use complex syntax, like nested curly braces, just to define the boundaries of your logic.
But looking at the Python syllabus, the syntax reads like a simple, bulleted to-do list.
Exactly.
If you want the program to display a greeting, you literally just type the word print, open a parenthesis, and type, hello, world.
That's it.
No memory allocation, no defining the output stream. It's remarkably human.
And that human-centric design goes even deeper with things like dynamic typing.
Wait, what is dynamic typing?
So in a language like Java, if you want to store someone's age, you have to formally declare to the machine, I am creating a variable, and it will only ever hold integers.
Oh.
But in Python, you just type age equals 25. The language figures out on its own that 25 is a number.
So it's saving the developer, like, mental bandwidth.
Huge amounts of it.
And the syllabus points out another huge stylistic shift, the lack of those curly braces we mentioned. Python uses indentation to define blocks of code.
Literal blank spaces.
Wow.
Yeah, if you write a loop, the actions inside that loop have to be indented. This forces developers to write visually clean, structured code natively.
So you can't just jumble it all together.
No, you physically cannot write a messy, sprawling, unreadable block of text in Python. The language's parser will just reject it.
Okay, wait. If this is built to be this simple, readable, and essentially English-like, how is it actually communicating with the CTU?
The million-dollar question.
Because a processor doesn't speak English. If we are skipping all those explicit instructions and memory allocations, what is acting as the translator between my nice little to-do list and the machine?
Right, let's pull back the curtain on the mechanics here. So Python is what's known as an interpreted language, which operates fundamentally differently from a compiled language like C++ MIT.
Okay, break that down for me.
Sure. When you write C++S, a compiler translates your entire program into raw machine-level binary before you ever run it.
Before it runs, got it.
Right. It hands the CPU a completed instruction manual.
So Python is doing this translation, what, dynamically?
Exactly. Step one, the default Python interpreter, which is called CPython, reads your source code and translates it into an intermediate format called bytecode.
Bytecode.
Yeah. Bytecode is a lower-level representation of your code, a sort of universal shorthand. It isn't human-readable anymore, but it isn't raw machine binary yet either.
It's just hovering in this middle ground.
Yep. And step two is where the magic happens. That bytecode is handed off to the Python virtual machine, or the PVM.
Okay, the PVM.
The PVM is the runtime engine. It takes that shorthand bytecode and executes it line by line on the fly, translating it into the specific instructions that your unique computer's processor can execute.
Okay, it's essentially acting like a real-time interpreter at the United Nations. You speak English into the microphone, and the interpreter translates it into the listener's native language a split second later.
That is a perfect analogy, yes.
Yeah.
But that real-time interpretation introduces a massive mechanical reality that we have to address.
Well, yeah, because if the PVM is translating everything on the fly, line by line, isn't that inherently going to drag down the processing speed compared to a language that pre-compiled the whole manual in advance?
It absolutely does.
I knew it.
Yeah. Python is structurally slower to execute than compiled languages.
Yeah.
And the sources from the training syllabus are very transparent about this limitation.
They don't hide it.
Not at all. It consumes more memory, it isn't ideal for native mobile applications, and it has a very famous structural bottleneck called the global interpreter lock.
The GIL.
The GIL, exactly.
Let's get into the weeds on the GIL, because that comes up constantly in high-level programming discussions. What is it actually locking?
Okay, to understand the GIL, you have to understand how Python manages memory. It uses something called reference counting.
Reference counting.
Right. Every time you create an object in Python, say, a list of customer names, Python keeps a hidden counter of how many variables are pointing to that list.
Okay.
When that counter hits zero, Python knows it's safe to delete the list and free up the memory.
So it's cleaning up after the developer automatically.
Exactly. But imagine a scenario where your computer is using true multi-threading, running multiple parallel tasks simultaneously.
Right, like most modern computers do.
If two different threads try to increase or decrease that reference counter at the exact same millisecond, the counter gets corrupted. The system might delete data that is still being used, causing a catastrophic crash.
Oh, so the threads are essentially colliding.
Yes. So the GIL steps in to manage the traffic.
I see.
The GIL acts as a master lock on the entire Python interpreter. It ensures that only one thread can execute Python bytecode at a time, even if your computer has a 16-core processor capable of doing many things at once.
Wait, really? So it forces a multi-lane highway down to a single lane just to guarantee that memory management stays perfectly safe.
That is exactly what it does.
It prioritizes stability over parallel speed. But hold on, the 2026 data we're looking at mentions a major shift happening with Python 3.13 and beyond regarding something called JIT compilation.
Ah, yes. Just-in-time compilation. What's fascinating here is that this is the community's brilliant solution to the speed problem.
How does it work?
So instead of purely interpreting line by line forever, a JIT compiler acts as an observer inside the PVM. It watches your program run and identifies the hotspots.
Hotspots, like areas of heavy traffic.
Exactly, the specific blocks of code that execute repeatedly, like a heavy mathematical loop.
So instead of translating that same loop 1,000 times in real time, the JIT steps in.
Yes, it pauses, compiles that specific loop all the way down to raw machine code on the fly, and caches it. The next time the program hits that loop, it completely bypasses the PVM interpreter and runs the lightning-fast machine code directly. It's a hybrid approach, giving you the ease of Python with bursts of C-like speed.
That is incredibly smart. But even with JIT closing the gap, we are still looking at a language that has historically traded raw machine performance for user-friendliness.
Very true.
Which brings up the biggest question of this whole deep dive. If it was slower, use more memory, and had this single-lane traffic bottleneck for decades, Why is it the foundation of the modern tech stack?
It comes down to a fundamental economic reality that shifted over the last 20 years. Computing power became incredibly cheap. Developer time became astronomically expensive.
Oh, that makes sense.
The tech industry happily accepted a philosophical trade-off. They sacrificed machine execution speed to maximize human execution speed.
It makes complete business sense. Like, if you're a startup, it is drastically cheaper to rent faster cloud servers to run slower Python code than it is to pay a team of senior software engineers to spend 6 months writing highly complex, lightning-fast C++ mail.
Exactly. Python allows a single developer to prototype, test, and launch an application in a fraction of the time. The clean syntax means debugging is faster.
And onboarding new team members is faster because they can actually read the code?
Precisely. But that ease of use is really only half the story.
The true superpower.
The primary reason Python dominates the global landscape is PyPI, the PyCon Package Index.
The PyPI.
Because Python is open source and has been accumulating community contributions since 1991, developers have built over 500,000 third-party packages.
500,000. And those packages act as, like, specialized plugins.
Exactly. Imagine you need to build a machine learning model to analyze financial data. If you were starting from scratch, you'd have to write hundreds of thousands of lines of complex linear algebra and calculus algorithms.
Which sounds like a nightmare.
It is. But in Python, you simply type import NumPy or import TensorFlow.
And instantly, your simple 20-line script inherits the power of a massive, pre-built artificial intelligence engine.
Right. And what's fascinating about these packages is how they solve Python's speed problem natively.
Wait, how so?
Libraries like NumPy or Pandas are actually written in highly optimized C or Fortran under the hood.
Oh, so Python acts as the interface. It's like a universal remote control.
I love that analogy.
Yeah. The remote itself isn't processing the movie or cooling the air or pumping the audio, but it seamlessly connects to the TV, the AC unit, and the sound system. You don't need to know how to build the appliances. You just press a button on the remote, and Python sends the instructions to the heavy-duty C code in the background.
It is the ultimate glue language. You get the human-readable simplicity of Python to orchestrate the lightning-fast execution of lower-level languages.
And because it operates as this incredible glue with 500,000 plugins, it naturally positioned itself to be the bedrock for the biggest technological leap of our decade, generative AI.
Oh, the dominance here is absolute. The architectural work for large language models training GPT, fine-tuning Llama, building neural networks is done almost entirely within the Python ecosystem.
Almost entirely. That's huge.
It is. The community had already built the specific mathematical tools required for deep learning long before AI became a mainstream buzzword.
And to really grasp the scale of this AI boom, we have to look at the physical infrastructure supporting it. The syllabus we're analyzing comes from Brawley Academy, which gives us a localized look at Hyderabad, India.
Affectionately known as Cyberbad.
Cyberbad, right.
And Hyderabad is a phenomenal case study. It's one of the premier technology hubs globally, hosting massive campuses for Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Apple.
And what we see in this specific local ecosystem is a reflection of a massive global upskilling trend.
Definitely.
Brawley Academy isn't just tucked away on some purely digital platform. The sources detail its physical location right near the JNTU metro station, Pillar A689. You have this tangible physical infrastructure built explicitly to transition the workforce into the Python ecosystem. And the demand driving that transition is just enormous.
The data points to over 10,000 active Python job listings in Hyderabad alone, with a year-over-year growth rate of 28%.
28%.
Yeah. That kind of concentrated, localized explosion isn't just about big tech companies building consumer apps.
It permeates everything. It's the local government's e-governance initiatives. It's the startup ecosystem in Banjara Hills building specialized tech.
Exactly. And the curriculum at Brawley Academy reflects how deeply specialized the market have become. They aren't just teaching generic coding anymore.
What are they focusing on?
Well, the syllabus is split into distinct tracks. You have Python full stack for building complex web architecture, and you have Python with machine learning and data science for the AI boom.
So they are actively training people to operate those 500,000 PyPI packages.
That's exactly it.
And the compensation data in the source really highlights the economic gravity of the skill set. Freshers in Hyderabad are starting between 3.5 to 6 lakhs per annum.
And for context, for our listeners, a lakh is 100,000 rupees. So we are looking at 350,000 to 600,000 rupees a year for entry-level talent.
But the ceiling is what's truly staggering. As you specialize specifically into roles like AI or machine learning engineer using Python, those salaries scale up past 30 lakhs per annum.
Yeah, that's 3 million rupees a year.
Which represents a massive leap in local purchasing power and economic mobility.
It proves that specialized knowledge in Python's AI libraries is just one of the most highly valued commodities in the global labor market today.
So let's bring this directly to you, the listener. Why does a deep dive into a Dutch programmer's holiday project, you know, the nuts and bolts of bytecode and the job market in Cyberbad matter for your Tuesday morning?
Right.
Even if you have absolutely no intention of ever applying for a software engineering job, this data is a massive flashing signpost about where the entire global economy is heading.
Because Python has completely transcended the software engineering department. It is no longer a niche tool reserved for people building apps.
The sources explicitly outline how it has infected every other major industry. If you're a financial analyst, you're using Python to model risk.
Yeah, and if you're in healthcare, researchers are using libraries like BioPython for medical image analysis and drug discovery.
Marketers are using it to automate data scraping and build customer algorithms.
It is rapidly becoming the new Excel.
The new Excel, yes.
20 or 30 years ago, if you wanted to work in a corporate environment, you had to know how to use a spreadsheet. It was the baseline expectation.
Right.
Well, in 2026, if you want to leverage massive data sets, automate your repetitive workflows, or interface directly with artificial intelligence, understanding the fundamentals of Python is becoming that new baseline.
It empowers you to build your own universal remote.
Exactly.
So what is the grand takeaway from this 2026 syllabus and our look under the hood today?
I think the ultimate lesson of Python is that technology doesn't win by being the most mathematically complex or the fastest at the machine level.
Right.
Python won the programming wars because it prioritized the human experience.
Yeah.
By making the language intuitive, clean, and readable, Guido van Rossum lowered the barrier to entry.
And by lowering that barrier, he invited millions of people to contribute.
He built the packages, they shared the tools, and they democratized complex computing. It is a true testament to the fact that when you make technology accessible, the community will build the future for you.
It took the intimidating, impenetrable skyscraper of modern tech and installed a ground floor elevator that anyone can learn to operate.
I love that.
Guido van Rossum designed Python so humans could instruct machines using simple English-like logic. And today, that very language is the foundation for generative AI.
It really is.
So I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over today. As these AI models get incredibly sophisticated, and as they get better at understanding nuance and context, will the next great programming language just be you speaking plain English to an artificial intelligence that was built on Python?
Well, it's the ultimate evolution. The gap between human thought and machine action closing completely.
Keep questioning the systems around you. Keep exploring the foundations of the tools you rely on. And most importantly, keep learning. Because whether you are writing a simple automated to-do list or training the next great AI model, the power is quite literally at your fingertips.